Their executives have positioned their minds and their products in the mainstream market. For Chrysler, this means an electric minivan. For Ford, an electric Ranger. Given this position, they must deliver a sustaining technological impact from what is inherently a disruptive technology. They need a breakthrough in battery technology because they made the choice to somehow position electric vehicles as a sustaining technology. A battery breakthrough is not likely to be required of companies whose executives choose to harness or account for the basic laws of disruptive technology by creating a market in which the weaknesses of the electric vehicle become its strengths. Where will advances in battery technology eventually come from? Looking at the historical record, we can assert the following. The companies that ultimately achieve the advances in battery technology required to power cars for 150-mile cruises, if they are ever developed, will be those that pioneer the creation of a new value network using proven technology and then develop the sustaining technologies needed to carry them upward into more attractive markets. Our finding that well-managed companies are generally upwardly mobile and downwardly immobile, therefore, suggests that the impetus to find the battery breakthrough will indeed be strongest among the disruptive innovators, which will have built a low-end market for electric vehicles before trying to move upmarket toward the larger, more profitable mainstream. Distribution strategy for disruptive innovations. It has almost always been the case that disruptive products redefine the dominant distribution channels because dealers' economics, their models for how to make money, are powerfully shaped by the mainstream value network, just as the manufacturers are. Sony's disruptive introduction of convenient and reliable portable transistorized radios and televisions shifted the dominant retail channel from appliance and department stores with expensive sales support and field service networks required for sets built with vacuum tubes to volume-oriented, low-overhead discount retailers. Honda's disruptive motorbikes were rejected by mainstream motorcycle dealers, forcing the company to create a new channel among sporting goods retailers. We saw, in fact, that a major reason why Harley-Davidson's small bike initiative failed is that its dealers rejected it. The image and economics of the small Italian bikes Harley had acquired did not fit its dealer network. The reason disruptive technologies and new distribution channels frequently go hand in hand is, in fact, an economic one. Retailers and distributors tend to have very clear formulas for making money, as the histories of Kresge and Woolworth in Chapter 4 showed. Some make money by selling low volumes of big-ticket products at high margins. Others make money by selling large volumes at razor-thin margins that cover minimal operating overheads. Still others make their money servicing products already sold. Just as disruptive technologies don't fit the models of established firms for improving profits, they often don't fit the models of their distributors either. My electric vehicle program would therefore have as a basic strategic premise the need to find or create new distribution channels for electric vehicles. Unless proven otherwise, I'd bet that mainstream dealers of gasoline-powered automobiles would not view the sorts of disruptive electric vehicles we have in mind as critical to their success. What organization best serves disruptive innovations? After identifying the electric vehicle as a potentially disruptive technology, setting realistic bearings for finding its potential markets, and establishing strategic parameters for the product's design, technology, and distribution network, as program manager, I would next turn to organization. Creating an organizational context in which this effort can prosper will be crucial because rational resource allocation processes in established companies consistently deny disruptive technologies the resources they need to survive, regardless of the commitment senior management may ostensibly have made to the program. Spinning off an independent organization. As we saw in the discussion of resource dependence in Chapter 5, established firms that successfully built a strong market position in a disruptive technology were those that spun off from the mainstream company an independent, autonomously operated organization. Quantum, Control Data, IBM's PC division, Allen Bradley, and Hewlett-Packard's DeskJet initiative all succeeded because they created organizations whose survival was predicated upon successful commercialization of the disruptive technology. These firms embedded a dedicated organization squarely within the emerging value network. As program manager, therefore, I would strongly urge corporate management to create an independent organization to commercialize electric vehicle technology, either an autonomous business unit, such as GM's Saturn division, or the IBM PC division, or an independent company whose stock is largely owned by the corporation. In an independent organization, my best employees would be able to focus on electric vehicles without being repeatedly withdrawn from the project to solve pressing problems for customers who pay the present bills. Demands from our own customers, on the other hand, would help us to focus on and lend impetus and excitement to our program. An independent organization would not only make resource dependence work for us rather than against us, but it would also address the principle that small markets cannot solve the growth or profit problems of large companies. For many years into the future, the market for electric vehicles will be so small that this business is unlikely to contribute significantly to the top or bottom lines of a major automaker's income statement. Thus, since senior managers at these companies cannot be expected to focus either their priority attention or their priority resources on electric vehicles, the most talented managers and engineers would be unlikely to want to be associated with our project, which must inevitably be seen as a financially insignificant effort. To secure their own futures within the company, they naturally will want to work on mainstream programs, not peripheral ones. In the early years of this new business, orders are likely to be denominated in hundreds, not tens of thousands. If we are lucky enough to get a few wins, they almost surely will be small ones. In a small, independent organization, these small wins will generate energy and enthusiasm. In the mainstream, they would generate skepticism about whether we should even be in the business. I want my organization's customers to answer the question of whether we should be in the business. I don't want to spend my precious managerial energy constantly defending our existence to efficiency analysts in the mainstream. Innovations are fraught with difficulties and uncertainties. Because of this, I want always to be sure that the projects that I manage are positioned directly on the path everyone believes the organization must take to achieve higher growth and greater profitability. If my program is widely viewed as being on that path, then I have confidence that when the inevitable problems arise, somehow the organization will work with me to muster whatever it takes to solve them and succeed. If, on the other hand, my program is viewed by key people as non-essential to the organization's growth and profitability, or even worse, is viewed as an idea that might erode profits, then even if the technology is simple, the project will fail. I can address this challenge in one of two ways. I could convince everyone in the mainstream, in their heads and their guts, that the disruptive technology is profitable, or I could create an organization that is small enough, with an appropriate cost structure, that my program can be viewed as being on its critical path to success. The latter alternative is a far more tractable management challenge. In a small, independent organization, I will more likely be able to create an appropriate attitude toward failure. Our initial stab into the market is not likely to be successful. We will, therefore, need the flexibility to fail, but to fail on a small scale, so that we can try again without having destroyed our credibility. Again, there are two ways to create the proper tolerance toward failure. Change the values and culture of the mainstream organization, or create a new organization. The problem with asking the mainstream organization to be more tolerant of risk-taking and failure is that, in general, we don't want to tolerate marketing failure when, as is most often the case, we are investing in sustaining technology change. The mainstream organization is involved in taking sustaining technological innovations into existing markets populated by known customers with researchable needs. Getting it wrong the first time is not an intrinsic part of these processes. Such innovations are amenable to careful planning and coordinated execution. Finally, I don't want my organization to have pockets that are too deep. While I don't want my people to feel pressure to generate significant profit for the mainstream company, this would force us into a fruitless search for an instant large market, I want them to feel constant pressure to find some way, some set of customers somewhere, to make our small organization cash positive as fast as possible. We need a strong motivation to accelerate through the trials and errors inherent in cultivating a new market. Of course, the danger in making this unequivocal call for spinning out an independent company is that some managers might apply this remedy indiscriminately, viewing skunkworks and spin-offs as a blanket solution, an industrial-strength aspirin that cures all sorts of problems. In reality, spinning out is an appropriate step only when confronting disruptive innovation. The evidence is very strong that large mainstream organizations can be extremely creative in developing and implementing sustaining innovations. In other words, the degree of disruptiveness inherent in an innovation provides a fairly clear indication of when a mainstream organization might be capable of succeeding with it and when it might be expected to fail. In terms of the framework presented in an earlier study, the electric vehicle is not only a disruptive innovation, but it involves massive architectural reconfiguration as well, a reconfiguration that must occur not only within the product itself, but across the entire value chain. From procurement through distribution, functional groups will have to interface differently than they have ever before. Hence, my project would need to be managed as a heavyweight team in an organization independent of the mainstream company. This organizational structure cannot guarantee the success of our electric vehicle program, but it would at least allow my team to work in an environment that accounts for, rather than fights, the principles of disruptive innovation. Chapter 11. The Dilemmas of Innovation. A Summary. One of the most gratifying outcomes of the research reported in this book is the finding that managing better, working harder, and not making so many dumb mistakes is not the answer to the innovator's dilemma. This discovery is gratifying because I have never met a group of people who are smarter or work harder or are as right so often as the managers I know. If finding better people than these were the answer to the problems posed by disruptive technologies, the dilemma would indeed be intractable. We have learned in this book that in their straightforward search for profit and growth, some very capable executives in some extraordinarily successful companies, using the best managerial techniques, have led their firms toward failure. Yet companies must not throw out the capabilities, organizational structures, and decision-making processes that have made them successful in their mainstream markets just because they don't work in the face of disruptive technological change. The vast majority of the innovation challenges they will face are sustaining in character, and these are just the sorts of innovations that these capabilities are designed to tackle. Managers of these companies simply need to recognize that these capabilities, cultures, and practices are valuable only in certain conditions. I have found that many of life's most useful insights are often quite simple. In retrospect, many of the findings of this book fit that mold. Initially, they seemed somewhat counterintuitive, but as I came to understand them, the insights were revealed as simple and sensible. I review them here, in the hope that they will prove useful to those readers who may be wrestling with the innovator's dilemmas. First, the pace of progress that markets demand, or can absorb, may be different from the progress offered by technology. This means that products that do not appear to be useful to our customers today, that is, disruptive technologies, may squarely address their needs tomorrow. Recognizing this possibility, we cannot expect our customers to lead us toward innovations that they do not now need. Therefore, while keeping close to our customers is an important management paradigm for handling sustaining innovations, it may provide misleading data for handling disruptive ones. Trajectory maps can help to analyze conditions and reveal which situation a company faces. Second, managing innovation mirrors the resource allocation process. Innovation proposals that get the funding and manpower they require may succeed. Those given lower priority, whether formally or de facto, will starve for lack of resources and have little chance of success. One major reason for the difficulty of managing innovation is the complexity of managing the resource allocation process. A company's executives may seem to make resource allocation decisions, but the implementation of those decisions is in the hands of a staff whose wisdom and intuition have been forged in the company's mainstream value network. They understand what the company should do to improve profitability. Keeping a company successful requires that employees continue to hone and exercise that wisdom and intuition. This means, however, that until other alternatives that appear to be financially more attractive have disappeared or been eliminated, managers will find it extraordinarily difficult to keep resources focused on the pursuit of a disruptive technology. Third, just as there is a resource allocation side to every innovation problem, matching the market to the technology is another. Successful companies have a practiced capability in taking sustaining technologies to market, routinely giving their customers more and better versions of what they say they want. This is a valued capability for handling sustaining innovation, but it will not serve the purpose when handling disruptive technologies. If, as most successful companies try to do, a company stretches or forces a disruptive technology to fit the needs of current mainstream customers, as we saw happen in the disk drive, excavator, and electric vehicle industries, it is almost sure to fail. Historically, the more successful approach has been to find a new market that values the current characteristics of the disruptive technology. Disruptive technology should be framed as a marketing challenge, not a technological one. Fourth, the capabilities of most organizations are far more specialized and context-specific than most managers are inclined to believe. This is because capabilities are forged within value networks. Hence, organizations have capabilities to take certain new technologies into certain markets. They have disabilities in taking technology to market in other ways. Organizations have the capability to tolerate failure along some dimensions and an incapacity to tolerate other types of failure. They have the capability to make money when gross margins are at one level and an inability to make money when margins are at another. They may have the capability to manufacture profitability at particular ranges of volume and order size and be unable to make money with different volumes or sizes of customers. Typically, their product development cycle times and the steepness of the ramp to production that they can negotiate are set in the context of their value network. All of these capabilities, of organizations and of individuals, are defined and refined by the types of problems tackled in the past, the nature of which has also been shaped by the characteristics of the value networks in which the organizations and individuals have historically competed. Very often, the new markets enabled by disruptive technologies require very different capabilities along each of these dimensions. Fifth, in many instances, the information required to make large and decisive investments in the face of disruptive technology simply does not exist. It needs to be created through fast, inexpensive, and flexible forays into the market and the product. The risk is very high that any particular idea about the product attributes or market applications of a disruptive technology may not prove to be viable. Failure and iterative learning are therefore intrinsic to the search for success with a disruptive technology. Successful organizations, which ought not and cannot tolerate failure in sustaining innovations, find it difficult simultaneously to tolerate failure in disruptive ones. Although the mortality rate for ideas about disruptive technologies is high, the overall business of creating new markets for disruptive technologies need not be inordinately risky. Managers who don't bet the farm on their first idea, who leave room to try, fail, learn quickly, and try again, can succeed at developing the understanding of customers, markets, and technology needed to commercialize disruptive innovations. Sixth, it is not wise to adopt a blanket technology strategy to be always a leader or always a follower. Companies need to take distinctly different postures depending on whether they are addressing a disruptive or a sustaining technology. Disruptive innovations entail significant first-mover advantages. Leadership is important. Sustaining situations, however, very often do not. The evidence is quite strong that companies whose strategy is to extend the performance of conventional technologies through consistent incremental improvements do about as well as companies whose strategy is to take big, industry-leading technological leaps. Seventh and last, the research summarized in this book suggests that there are powerful barriers to entry and mobility that differ significantly from the types defined and historically focused on by economists. Economists have extensively described barriers to entry and mobility and how they work. A characteristic of almost all of these formulations, however, is that they relate to things, such as assets or resources, that are difficult to obtain or replicate. Perhaps the most powerful protection that small entrant firms enjoy as they build the emerging markets for disruptive technologies is that they are doing something that it simply does not make sense for the established leaders to do. Despite their endowments in technology, brand names, manufacturing prowess, management experience, distribution muscle, and just plain cash, successful companies populated by good managers have a genuinely hard time doing what does not fit their model for how to make money. Because disruptive technologies rarely make sense during the years when investing in them is most important, conventional managerial wisdom at established firms constitutes an entry and mobility barrier that entrepreneurs and investors can bank on. It is powerful and pervasive. Established companies can surmount this barrier, however. The dilemmas posed to innovators by the conflicting demands of sustaining and disruptive technologies can be resolved. Managers must first understand what these intrinsic conflicts are. They then need to create a context in which each organization's market position, economic structure, developmental capabilities, and values are sufficiently aligned with the power of their customers that they assist, rather than impede, the very different work of sustaining and disruptive innovators. I hope this book helps them in this effort. The Innovator's Dilemma Book Group Guide. The summary and questions in this guide are designed to stimulate thinking and discussion about the Innovator's Dilemma, how its findings are manifest in many industries today, and the implications of those findings for the future. Thesis of the book. In The Innovator's Dilemma, Professor Clayton Christensen asks the question, why do well-managed companies fail? He concludes that they often fail because the very management practices that have allowed them to become industry leaders also make it extremely difficult for them to develop the disruptive technologies that ultimately steal away their markets. Well-managed companies are excellent at developing the sustaining technologies that improve the performance of their products in the ways that matter to their customers. This is because their management practices are biased toward listening to customers, investing aggressively in technologies that give those customers what they say they want, seeking higher margins, targeting larger markets rather than smaller ones. Disruptive technologies, however, are distinctly different from sustaining technologies. Disruptive technologies change the value proposition in a market. When they first appear, they almost always offer lower performance in terms of the attributes that mainstream customers care about. In computer disk drives, for example, disruptive technologies have always had less capacity than the old technologies. But disruptive technologies have other attributes that a few fringe, generally new, customers value. They are typically cheaper, smaller, simpler, and frequently more convenient to use. Therefore, they open new markets. Further, because with experience and sufficient investment, the developers of disruptive technologies will always improve their product's performance, they eventually are able to take over the older markets. This is because they are able to deliver sufficient performance on the old attributors, and they add some new ones. The innovator's dilemma describes both the processes through which disruptive technologies supplant older technologies and the powerful forces within well-managed companies that make them unlikely to develop those technologies themselves. Professor Christensen offers a framework of four principles of disruptive technology to explain why the management practices that are the most productive for exploiting existing technologies are anti-productive when it comes to developing disruptive ones. And finally, he suggests ways that managers can harness these principles so that their companies can become more effective at developing for themselves the new technologies that are going to capture their markets in the future. Principles of disruptive technology. 1. Companies depend on customers and investors for resources. In order to survive, companies must provide customers and investors with the products, services, and profits that they require. The highest performing companies, therefore, have well-developed systems for killing ideas that their customers don't want. As a result, these companies find it very difficult to invest adequate resources in disruptive technologies, lower margin opportunities that their customers don't want, until their customers want them. And by then, it is too late. 2. Small markets don't solve the growth needs of large companies. To maintain their share prices and create internal opportunities for their employees, successful companies need to grow. It isn't necessary that they increase their growth rates, but they must maintain them. And as they get larger, they need increasing amounts of new revenue just to maintain the same growth rate. Therefore, it becomes progressively more difficult for them to enter the newer, smaller markets that are destined to become the large markets of the future. To maintain their growth rates, they must focus on large markets. 3. Markets that don't exist can't be analyzed. Sound market research and good planning followed by execution according to plan are the hallmarks of good management. But companies whose investment processes demand quantification of market size and financial returns before they can enter a market get paralyzed when faced with disruptive technologies because they demand data on markets that don't yet exist. 4. Technology supply may not equal market demand. Although disruptive technologies can initially be used only in small markets, they eventually become competitive in mainstream markets. This is because the pace of technological progress often exceeds the rate of improvement that mainstream customers want or can absorb. As a result, the products that are currently in the mainstream eventually will overshoot the performance that mainstream markets demand, while the disruptive technologies that underperform relative to customer expectations in the mainstream market today may become directly competitive tomorrow. Once two or more products are offering adequate performance, customers will find other criteria for choosing. These criteria tend to move toward reliability, convenience, and price, all of which are areas in which the newer technologies often have advantages. A big mistake that managers make in dealing with new technologies is that they try to fight or overcome the principles of disruptive technology. Applying the traditional management practices that lead to success with sustaining technologies always leads to failure with disruptive technologies, says Professor Christensen. The more productive route, which often leads to success, he says, is to understand the natural laws that apply to disruptive technologies and to use them to create new markets and new products. Only by recognizing the dynamics of how disruptive technologies develop can managers respond effectively to the opportunities that they present. Specifically, he advises managers faced with disruptive technologies to 1. Give responsibility for disruptive technologies to organizations whose customers need them so that resources will flow to them. 2. Set up a separate organization small enough to get excited by small gains. 3. Plan for failure. Don't bet all your resources on being right the first time. Think of your initial efforts at commercializing a disruptive technology as learning opportunities. Make revisions as you gather data. 4. Don't count on breakthroughs. Move ahead early and find the market for the current attributes of the technology. You will find it outside the current mainstream market. You will also find that the attributes that make disruptive technologies unattractive to mainstream markets are the attributes on which the new markets will be built. Questions for discussion. 1. The characteristics of a disruptive technology are: they are simpler and cheaper and lower performing. They generally promise lower margins, not higher profits. Leading firms' most profitable customers generally can't use and don't want them. They are first commercialized in emerging or insignificant markets. The Innovator's Dilemma discusses disruptive innovations in the disk drive, excavator, steel, and auto industries. Looking back through history, can you identify some disruptive technologies that eventually replaced older products and industries? Can you think of others that are emerging today? Maybe even ones that could threaten your business. 2. There is a tendency in all markets for companies to move upmarket toward more complicated products with higher prices. Why is it difficult for companies to enter markets for simpler, cheaper products? Can you think of companies that have upscaled themselves out of business? How might they have avoided that? 3. The same tendency for companies to move up market that can be fatal for established companies also accounts for the eventual development of emerging markets into mainstream markets. Besides the examples in the book, can you think of companies that have upscaled themselves to success? 4. In attempting to commercialize a disruptive technology, why is it important to begin investing on the assumption that your expectations will be wrong? Besides the motorcycle, excavator, and disk drive examples in the book, can you think of other examples in which a company began marketing a product for one application, but the big market turned out to be for another application? 5. One of the hallmarks of disruptive technologies is that initially they underperform the current technology on the attributes that matter most to mainstream customers. The companies that succeed in commercializing them, therefore, must find different customers for whom the new technology's attributes are most valuable. Can you think of any markets that are emerging today based on attributes or qualities that seemed unimportant to the mainstream markets when they were introduced? What older mainstream products or companies are threatened? 6. When two or more products meet the minimum specifications for the functionality of a product, customers begin to look for other deciding factors. According to a Windermere Associates study cited in the book, the progression usually is from functionality to reliability to convenience to price. What are some current markets that have recently moved one or more steps along this progression? 7. Most people think that senior executives make the important decisions about where a company will go and how it will invest its resources. But the real power lies with the people deeper in the organization who decide which proposals will be presented to senior management. What are the corporate factors that lead mid-level employees to ignore or kill disruptive technologies? Should well-managed companies change these practices and policies? 8. What are the personal career considerations that lead ambitious employees in large corporations to ignore or kill disruptive technologies? Should well-managed companies change the policies that encourage employees to think this way? 9. What do the findings in this book suggest about how companies will be organized in the future? Should large organizations with structures created around functionalities redesign themselves into interconnected teams, as some management theorists currently believe? Or, recognizing that different technologies and different markets have differing needs, should they try to have distinct organizational structures and management practices for different circumstances? Is this realistically possible? 10. The CEO of a disk drive maker is quoted in Chapter 4 as saying that we got way ahead of the market, in explaining why his company failed to commercialize a 1.8-inch disk drive that it had developed. At the time, however, there was a burgeoning market for 1.8-inch drives among new users that his company hadn't discovered. Professor Christensen argues that disruptive technology should be framed as a marketing challenge, not a technological one. Do you think there is a market somewhere for all technologies? If not, how would you, as a manager, go about figuring out which technologies to shelve and which ones to pursue aggressively? 11. Similarly, Professor Christensen argues that companies should not wait for new breakthroughs to improve a technology's performance. Instead, they need to find customers who value the very attributes that others consider to be shortcomings. As a manager, how do you decide when a technology or idea needs more development and when it's time to aggressively put it on the market? 12. The primary thesis of the Innovator's Dilemma is that the management practices that allow companies to be leaders in mainstream markets are the same practices that cause them to miss the opportunities offered by disruptive technologies. In other words, well-managed companies fail because they are well-managed. Do you think that the definition of what constitutes good management is changing? In the future, will listening to customers, investing aggressively in producing what those customers say they want, and carefully analyzing markets become bad management? What kind of system might combine the best of both worlds? This has been a Highbridge production, read by L.J. Ganser. Copyright 1997-2000-2016 by the President and Fellows of Harvard College. Published by arrangement with Harvard Business School Press. Recording copyright 2017 by Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.